This conference will now be recorded.
Hi, everyone. This is Sandy Fazzelli from the National Association of State Energy Officials. We're all on the line for the August Financing Committee call, which we're holding in partnership with NASIO's Fuels and Integration Committee. Could I get the name and organization of folks who are on the line?
Hey, Sandy Malcolm with Advanced Energy Economy.
Hey, Malcolm.
Mark Ames, ASHRAE.
Hey, Mark.
Chris McDonald, CMME.
Hi, Chris.
Jack Osterman, Nebraska State Energy Office.
Hey, Jack.
Glenn Astroff, CMME.
Hey,
Monica Hazzarini, DMME.
Hi, Buena.
Emma Krause, DOER.
Hey, Emma.
Hi there. Jeff Pitkins on.
Hey, Jeff.
John Joshi, oh. NYSERDA.
Hey, John.
Al Christopher.
Hi, Al.
Hello.
Dan Brissett from Maryland Energy Administration.
Hey, Dan.
Alexander Mack, Florida.
Hi, Alexander.
This is Alexa Wojtek with Tennessee.
Hey, Alexa.
Hi.
Hey, Pete.
John Soto from American Samoa Energy Office.
Okay, I heard Alabama and American Samoa.
That is Tama, yes.
Okay, great.
This is Dave Dayton, a consultant to DMME.
Hey, Dave.
Becca Treach, Rhode Island Office of Energy.
Hey there.
Marissa Sakuda, State of Hawaii Office of Energy.
Hey, Marissa.
Mark Blick. The Hawaii State Energy Office.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Hey, Sandy, Deb Taylor, Texas.
Hi, Deb.
Hello.
Hi, Mark.
Hey. Tom Kimbis and Amir Yazdi from SIA.
Hi, Tom and Amir. Okay, great. Let me go
to the Michigan Energy Office.
Hey there, Kathy.
No, it was Tanya.
Oh, Tanya. Sorry about that. Okay, I've got Advanced Energy Economy, ASHRAE, the Virginia Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy, Nebraska, Massachusetts, New York, Maryland, Florida, Tennessee, Alabama, American Samoa, Rhode Island, Hawaii, Texas, SIA, and Michigan. Is there anyone I've missed?
Washington State.
Hello, Washington State. Okay, great. Then I think we can get started, and I'll turn the call over to the Financing Committee co-chairs, Al Christopher and Jeff Pitkin, to get us started.
Thank you, Sandy. I'm Al Christopher, Director of the State Energy Office of Virginia, DMME, and this is well-timed call for us. We're very interested in advancing solar in Virginia, so I'm looking forward to this. It sounds like we have a virtual who's who of solar on this call, too. The call will look at the marketplace for solar energy, some key financing policy and planning considerations for state energy offices and others. Just a reminder that you can follow along the speakers' PowerPoint presentations. They're available on NASIO's Financing Committee page, which is www.nasio.org/committee-financing. And you can find them on the financing event sidebar, which is on the right side of that page. If anybody's having trouble finding that or downloading anything, you could email Sandy. And I will now turn it over to my colleague and co-chair, Jeff Pitkin of NYSERDA.
Thanks, Al. I just wanted to quickly note that we're excited to be co-hosting today's call with the NASIO Fuels and Grid Integration Committee, which examines how states can promote energy sector resiliency by promoting distributed generation, renewable energy, combined heat and power, and other innovations, And I wanted to call on Dub Taylor, one of the co-chairs of the Fuels and Grid Integration Committee, and see if he wanted to make a few opening remarks. Dub?
Nothing really additional. Jeff, thanks. That's that covers a description of the committee that Mark Glick, who's also on the line from Hawaii, and I co-chair. And I would just say that oftentimes, in all of our organizations and our business, we tend to get stovepiped and put the blinders on. Kudos to NASIO for helping identify where there's overlap between the two committees, finance and fuels and grid integration, and bringing these two committees together for this particular set of presentations. So, and welcome to all the attendees. Mark, I know you're on the line. Anything to add?
No, yeah, I think you said it perfectly, Dub. Welcome, everyone.
Al, do you want to go forward and introduce the first presenters? Al?
Yes, Al stepped out for a second. He'll be right over.
Go.
Maybe, Jeff, you should go ahead and...
So we have three presenters today who are going to walk us through work that they've done and the networks that they're using to advance the solar market in their respective areas. And we're anticipating a lively discussion to follow. And also want to share some information about, hope that folks will share information about programs that your state or company is involved in. First speaker is Emma Krause from the Massachusetts Department of Energy Resources. Second speaker will be Malcolm Wolf from Advanced Energy Economy, which is a NASIO affiliate member and a former chair of NASIO. And the third speaker will be Tom Kimbis from the Solar Energy Industry Association. So Emma, do you want to get started then?
For sure. Hello, everyone. I hope you're all doing well. Apologies, but I don't have slides for you to look at. I must have missed the memo of passing them along to be posted for everyone to access. But the presentation that I'm going to speak to is actually on DOER's website. If everyone wants to just Google Mass Solar Loan Program Final Design, you should be able to pull up kind of what I'm referencing. There'll be a couple of changes based on what I say and what this PowerPoint currently is, just because we're in the midst of finalizing the program. But for the most part, it should be pretty comparative. So if you'd like to, I won't go through the whole presentation, but a lot of what I speak to will be in here. So feel free to ask questions as we go.
Emma, before you move on, this is Sandy. I'll just so everyone knows, we're having that link posted to the event page, so you can access it as well.
Oh, perfect.
Sorry,
thank
you.
No problem. So we're currently in the midst here in Massachusetts of implementing a residential solar loan program. It's a $30 million program that looks to leverage $30 million of state funding for local banks and credit unions to begin lending in the solar space. This approach for financing, it comes from some a study we did a couple years back in 2013 that took a look at the Massachusetts market and wanted to get a sense as to if direct ownership or third-party leasing would be more beneficial, mostly because we were seeing so much third-party leasing happening at the time. Not surprisingly, the study came back and demonstrated that direct ownership of solar PV was much more effective for individual homeowners and much more cost-effective for both individual homeowners and for local economies. So with this research, by the way, if you want to take a look at that study, it's also on our website. Mass Solar Loan page on our website located right there for you to look at. So with this knowledge in mind, we set forth to put together a solar loan program. A loan program comes in under our SREC 2 regulations. It's in there saying that we must put it together. So we've been working since late 2013, early 2014 to design and now implement that program. So it kind of speaks to some key goals. We want the program to be readily accessible for installers, customers, and lenders. And to be competitive, obviously, with third-party alternatives like PPAs or leases. We want to really help small installers secure attractive financing for customers and create an affordable solution for solar for folks. The big overarching goal here is to create a sustainable financing mechanism where after our money has been used to get the lender community involved and engaged and really understanding that solar is a revenue-generating asset and that therefore a good thing to loan for, we're hoping they'll continue to do these loans even after our funding sources run out. So this is kind of a bridge to hopefully a lot broader of a financing program going forward. So with that in mind, I'll just kind of go through piece by piece. There's three main mechanisms that make the program work. The first is a loan loss reserve. And each of these mechanisms speak to different folks who are kind of key stakeholders in the program. The loan loss reserve is really a key piece for lenders. And how it works is we took a look at sort of the common FICO scores that were across Massachusetts and found that a large portion of Massachusetts residents are at a 720 FICO score or above. One of the other key goals of the program is to be able to provide funding for solar for folks who are lower moderate income. And so in looking at the FICO structure, we're only providing loan loss reserve for specific FICO scores. If you're following me, I'm on slide 12 of the deck. I'm going to hop around just a little bit in the interest of time. If you look at slide 12, you'll see there's sort of our three different credit enhancement mechanisms, and loan loss reserve is for some very specific FICO scores. The reason we're only providing the loan loss reserve to lenders for those FICO scores is to try to essentially get them to loan to slightly lower FICO score and giving them a little bit of cushion in doing so. We recognize, and this is something that lenders were very adamant with us, that a FICO score doesn't necessarily denote that somebody is low or moderate income. But there is a bit of a chance, so we wanted to kind of cover that base. Lenders also don't have to loan to these FICO scores, but the incentive is there to get them to do it. Moving over to the column just to the left of loan loss reserve, interest rate buy-down. This is a piece, it's really for the customers. So what we've done is said that any lender who wants to be a part of our program can only cannot offer an interest rate that's higher than 6%. We've pegged this number to current Wall Street Journal Prime, and we'll constantly be checking and updating. But right now, that's kind of where it's holding steady. Any lender who then participates and sets their interest rate, we will buy down that interest rate by 3%. So the highest loan that somebody's going to get at the start of our program is going to be a 3% interest rate loan. We're going to buy it down for 3% until the first $5 million of our budget for the interest rate buy down is expended. And once it's been expended, we'll have to assess the program and assess whether we should continue to keep it at this level or whether we can ratchet it down. The hope is that we can ratchet the interest rate buy down over time. Because it really is something that kind of takes the funding away pretty quickly. We don't get to reinvest that money like we would the loan loss reserve. Then if you look to the column on the far right-hand side of the screen, moderate income loan support. This is the third sort of credit enhancement mechanism. This is to really get at customers who are moderate income. When we originally were designing the program, we were trying to get at folks who were both moderate income and low income. And it became clear through design, through a lot of stakeholder feedback from lenders and installers, that it was going to be more effective if we just started targeting moderate income folks and instead did a separate program for low income. And we've got a policy coordinator here, Joanna Troy, who's working on that program. And if anyone's curious at the end, I'm happy to provide contact information for her if you'd like to learn more. So the moderate income loan support takes a look at folks' median household income and provides a certain incentive amount based on that income. We've no longer got this base. In this slide, you can see that it's based on a output, but we've changed that now in our next sort of iteration of our program design to instead based off percentage. Mainly because we don't think lenders will know sort of the output terminology. The main goal here is to be able to get borrowers a little bit more comfortable with lending to folks who are moderate income. And the way this piece works is essentially like a grant. So if you qualify as moderate income, it would be, you know, just say $25,000 loan. I qualify as moderate income. I get a $2,500 an income buy down. That would be given immediately to the lender up front and would bring down the principal of the loan and give them a little bit of comfort that some of the loan has been paid off up front. So those are sort of our three credit enhancement provisions. If you look to the far left of the table on slide 12, you'll see that we also mandate that lenders have to offer a term of 10 years. This is because our SRX2 program here, our main solar incentive program, is a 10-year program. And so it, in doing the financial modeling, it becomes clear very quickly that you get the best sort of return on your investment between the federal tax credit, a state tax credit, and the SRX program if you match it up with the terms of the SRX. So lenders have to offer a term of 10 years, but they can also offer others. If they want to offer a 12 as well or a 7 or what have you, they're welcome to do that. Where we are right now with this is we're currently working to implement. We are working on recruiting lenders, building a portal for the platform for both lenders and installers to use to access interested customers, signing on a moderate income verifier to do the work to ascertain if somebody is moderate income and is therefore eligible for our support, and also getting a technical consultant on board to do inspections of projects. The hope right now is we'll be able to launch in a little over a month's time. So working very hard to get that ready to go, but really hoping to be able to serve a good chunk of the market, the residential market with this, and provide a funding source that's more sustainable over time. With sort of conservative assumptions, I'm looking now at slide 18 if you're following along. With conservative assumptions, do you think we can leverage the $30 million that we've initially put into this about a little over 4.5 times? So supporting around $127 million of loans. So we're very excited to be able to launch this and put it out there. Last thing I'll mention, just going to slide 19, we're working with the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, our quasi-state agency. They're our central administrator for the program. So the ones really working that will be sort of overseeing the day-to-day operations of it, with us continuing to oversee them and ensuring the design is implemented effectively and making key decisions along the way to adjust as we go. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions anyone has or provide my email accordingly should you want to follow up at a later time.
Thanks, Emma. This is Sandy at NASUA again. I know that Massachusetts has a really robust kind of parallel program, loan program for energy efficiency, and I was wondering if there's going to be any effort, as far as you know, of coordinating these programs so, homes that might choose to install solar also have the opportunity to become energy efficient using Massachusetts financing.
Yes, it's a great question. So we did a lot of look, we call that the heat loan program here. We did a lot of research into that program to see if maybe we should just, make it another piece of the heat loan. One of the reasons we didn't do that is because it's different funding sources for each of these programs, and the heat loan funding, while not, replenishable for ever forward, there is replenishing of the funding each year for now. With the loan program, it's only one shot, $30 million to make this change. So we've differentiated them a little bit. We also, didn't want to create a big bubble in the market where, with the heat loans, it's a 0% interest rate. And if we did that with the solar loan program, sure, we buy down the interest rate to zero, and then when the funding runs out, it just shoots right back up. We wanted to do it in a more sustainable fashion, so that's why you see it's the lower interest rate. It's not a 0% one, and it's ratcheting down the buy down of it over time to get consumers in the solar industry comfortable. One thing we have done, which I believe is in an earlier slide, it's in the technical eligibility. It's a little further up in the borrower eligibility. The any homeowner who's going to be applying for the mass solar loan programs, they have to demonstrate that they have either had a mass save energy audit, so the audit that tells you what kind of heat loan work you can do, or that they're going to have one scheduled, or that they have one scheduled, rather, at the time of applying for the solar loan program. So trying to encourage people to either have looked at energy efficiency or ensure they are looking at it when they're applying for our program. The other thing we're really looking to do is encourage folks who are already heat loan lenders to also become lenders under our program, so that, you know, if they can pull in the customer pool that is perhaps, replace their insulation or windows or boiler or what have you, they can say, hey, you know, you've done some energy efficiency work and solar might be a great option for you. It's our next sort of loan project we have. Why don't you look into that? So definitely trying to coordinate the two programs as much as we can, and really mandating that folks who participate in the loan program have to have researched the heat loan program a little bit and made an effort towards at least looking into it before participating in the loan program.
Great. Emma, this is John Joshi from... Jeff, go ahead.
Go ahead, John. No, go ahead, John.
This is John Joshi from NYSERDA. I had a question regarding whether do you offer lender support in terms of origination cost, and is all the servicing on the loan centralized? And then the last part of the question would be in terms of O&M, maintenance and inverters and all those issues, the homeowners taking that risk, or is there some type of a policy or something offered to the homeowners in support of that?
Yeah, good questions. For the first one, if you look in slide 11, our parameters, you'll see down at the bottom there that we've put in a rule that lenders cannot exceed $500 in closing costs. A lot of the lenders we've talked to are looking at this like a construction loan, specifically because it's an unsecured loan. The idea behind that being that it's a subsidized state loan, so it's essentially in a way secured by government funding. And interestingly, some lenders have liked this a lot because it gives them less restrictive reporting requirements by calling it an unsecured loan. Because it's unsecured, it can be considered like a construction loan. And we've been told that closing costs and underwriting should not exceed that $500 amount and probably won't be very much. There's an option for them to file a UCC-1 if they want to do a little bit of security on the home. We've heard that would be very attractive for lenders and comfort them a little bit. That process of filing that UCC-1 also, we've been told, is not too expensive. So really looking for folks to not exceed that $500 limit. That is not right now included in the loan itself. But we did get some feedback from a lender that might be helpful. So it's something, as we're working towards our final documents, especially in the next couple of weeks, that we're going to be considering, thinking about. And then the second question, so just remind me what it was again?
The second question was on servicing the loans. Are they all desegregated, meaning each lender is doing it, or is there centralized servicing on that? And what's the cost structure on that servicing?
Right. In terms of servicing the loans, is each lender... Well, actually, I should back up. When you say servicing, do you mean taking in payments from the customer and ensuring that they're on time and whatnot?
Correct.
Yeah. So that's all on the lender's side, and them going about sort of their normal processes as they would with any type of loan, like a mortgage loan or a construction loan that they may normally be doing. In terms of the loan loss reserve, the interest rate buy down, the moderate income adder, and also a central area to kind of connect lenders with installers. We're building a portal to not only help us disperse those payments, but also provide a central place where lenders participating in the program can go and find qualified technical applications from installers that they can then choose to loan to. The goal in designing was to be able to make it an accessible entry. Essentially, customers could enter at any point they choose. They could enter through an installer. They could go to their local lender, who could then send them to our website where there's a list of installers, or they could just go to our website and pick an installer and go from there. The question you had about the O&M, we had a pretty successful Commonwealth Solar 2 rebate program in Massachusetts. In the past few years, it's just closed. And we've taken our technical criteria for this program from there. If you look at slide 8 and 9, you'll see sort of a small sampling. The warranty piece specifically for that technical eligibility, we've put in that the technical equipment has to have specific warranties in order to help deal with some of those O&M issues. There is, with this, we are leaving it to the homeowner to cover any of those costs should that be a problem. The other thinking there was, you know, if they're paying back the loan, it's a 15-year loan, and in year 12 something happens with the system, they're going to have a pretty good relationship with the bank at this point, and perhaps an opportunity to take out a little bit more of a loan to deal with that, or to deal with it on their own, considering that the utility bills will have gone down and they'll be making some decent revenue from the tax credit and our incentive program. So sort of the thinking there.
Thank you.
Emma, it's Jeff Pitkin. Just a real quick question because I want to make sure we can get on to the next presenters. Did I think I hear you say that you're intending to use some kind of an income verification service or process to determine income levels of the participants?
That's correct, yeah. So
maybe we can connect offline. I'd be very interested in hearing what approach or service you're using for that.
Yeah, happy to talk about it with you, sure.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah, this is Tom. If I may, I know it's to the interest of time and not going into details. I want to thank the financing committee for this conference call. It couldn't come in a better timing in terms of in relation to this major solar project that we have here in American Samoa that is about to launch here in any day now. So just to the interest of time, I just want to say that We're about to have a solar major project. This is for residentials, commercials, businesses here in American Samoa, and it's through collaboration of private financing and also my office, private sectors. Long story short, we're ready to have this started. We have 7 contractors with an EPC that consists of the investors and 2 other energy companies from the States. The reason why I don't want to go or I can't go any the details is because we are waiting for the first tranche release of the funding for the start of the project. And when we have that, we will have a press release. Probably if it comes any day now, it could be today or tomorrow, but most likely will be next week. So when we do have that that press release, then we'll basically give out all the details. It's basically it's through the end users and the utility here, through PPAs, power purchase agreements. So we've pretty much got all that down in place, and that includes the rooftop installations with storage, LED lighting, LED glass, and street lighting is all in that. Cost per kilowatt hour that has already been signed and ready to go with the private investors. So that's just like a nutshell of this announcement. But we will have a full presentation of this project in the San Diego National meeting here in the end of September. Again, thanks to the Financing Committee for the timing of this conference call.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Please don't hesitate to share that press release when it's out, and we'd love to look at how we can feature this as part of the Financing Committee meeting next month in San Diego.
And I'm sure you will hear about it when this press release goes out. I'm hoping it will be sometime next week.
Great. Congratulations.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Folks, this is Emma. I'm assuming we're going to need to move on because of time. If anyone would like to get in touch to learn more about our program or our implementation, my email is emma.krause@ state.ma.us, and happy to connect with folks if that's helpful.
Thanks, Emma. All right, Malcolm.
All right, thank you for that, for that presentation. Great, great job.
Okay. Thanks, guys. It's great to be have a chance to talk with so many friends again. It's been, I guess, only 2.5 years since I left the Nazio family and joined Advanced Energy Economy. Let me just encourage folks, if they can, to jump on the Nazio website and pull up the presentation. I've got a bunch of interesting graphs that I think will make this a little more interesting for you. Just by way of background, I'm now with a group called Advanced Energy Economy, a national business association focusing on public policy to expand the entire sector. So our memberships range from solar companies to wind companies to efficiency, natural gas. And then we've also got a number of national companies, GE, Microsoft, Apple. So it's a broad set of all of the advanced energy technologies. Nazio asked me in particular to join this call because of a recent report we put out, I guess, last month called The Competitiveness of Renewable Energy and Efficiency in U.S. Markets. Timing of this call today. So I'm out. Apologize if my dogs bark in the background. Apologies for that. One of the really cool things I've been able to see just in the last few years since I've moved over to the private sector is the rapid reduction of costs. So kind of hopefully complementing the prior presentation, I'm going to be a little bit big picture and try to give you a sense of how this market has changed really just over the last 3 years. It's a totally different renewables market. So if you haven't had a chance to kind of focus or just realize the extent of the transformation, hopefully this will be useful. Let me start, and for those of you able to follow along, I'm on slide 5, by encouraging you not to give, to rely on sources other than EIA. EIA has proven itself to be consistently underestimating renewable energy and efficiency for that matter. I sympathize with them. It's certainly hard to predict the future, but they've done a pretty good job of missing the present. So, for example, just to use a wind example, wind installations have averaged about 6.5 gigawatts per year. That's from 2007 to 2014. But the most recent EIA projections are 6.5 gigawatts between now and 2030. So it's less than 1/10 of the average over the last of recent years. We're not the only ones who've noted that EIA is consistently kind of misrepresenting the present. Last year, a Politico reporter, Michael Grunwald, had some really funny tweets when he was at an EIA conference. One that I particularly loved was, "We've had 5 consecutive weekdays, so EIA predicts that tomorrow will be a weekday too." So I'd encourage you guys, as you're looking at policies, look at NREL studies, look at the CS reports of what's actually in the pipeline. My heart goes out to EIA. Their models look at bulk systems, and so they're really missing what's become a major transformation in the market. On slide 5, I wanted just to highlight the new reality. Over the last 5 years, renewables have been at least or have been averaging 50% or more of new generation capacity. This year, it's expected to be 50 or 60% of new generation, with natural gas obviously being the bulk of the rest. So this change of renewables, solar and wind dominating the market is continuing, even despite the low natural gas prices. It's at least half of the market, and we think that's going to continue. Moving for this year, I think EIA estimates about 10 gigawatts of wind, over 2 gigawatts of solar, and then another 0.5 gigawatts of other renewables. And remember, EIA is consistently underestimating these things. So I think CIA's estimates are that there's about 6 gigawatts or over 6 gigawatts of solar in the pipeline. So we expect this generation to continue. Why is it happening? Slide 6, for the wind side of the sector, wind purchases are now driven by the economics. The chart that, for those of you able to see it, we looked at the average wind PPA prices nationwide and compared it to the nationwide wholesale power prices. And you'll see that wind has fluctuated, certainly with the uncertain tax market, but it is averaging now, you know, below the weighted average for PPAs nationally. Lots of examples in all of your states of companies buying wind just because it's the least cost resource. AEP in 2013 bought three times more wind in Oklahoma than it originally intended with its RFP because the prices came in so low. In 2014, we started seeing an emerging trend of corporations or non-utilities increasingly wanting to purchase renewables directly. And 23% of wind PPAs were with non-utility groups, largely corporations, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Walmarts. So that's another area where we're seeing renewables, both solar and wind, increasingly taking off. And that's a different, it's consumer customer-driven demand, which is a different dynamic. Solar is also increasingly competitive, as you all recognize. For those of you able to look at the chart, to me, it just underscores just how prices have dropped. It's dropped 60% for residential and small commercial between 2002 and 2013. So, it, you know, prices which used to be at $12 an installed watt are now down at the 3, 4, 5 cents an installed watt. That's for utility, commercial, and residential scale. And we're seeing this then in the marketplace. So, Dub, you know that Austin Energy signed a PPA last year for 150 megawatts of solar at a price estimated at less than $50 a megawatt hour. Lazard is now assuming that the capital cost for utility scale projects is about $1.50 in 2014 and falling to $1.25 by 2017. So even with the tax uncertainty, there's a reason that that we're having this call, that solar has really become is in many markets at grid parity or beyond grid parity, and therefore it's becoming a much bigger role here. The following slide just reflects how much that price drop is showing up in actual installed capacity. If you look at the installed capacity, it is just a straight line. It's likely to double between 2014 and 2016 based on projects actually in the pipeline. Again, I encourage folks not to give too much weight to EIA. They're actually predicting that the amount will double by 2026, whereas when we look at what's actually in the pipeline, we think it's going to double by the end of next year. So there's a lot of projects being built now. And this is in part why, if you look at the Clean Power Plan, part of how EPA justified the much stepped up renewables numbers was they started looking at DOE NREL estimates of what's going to be on the grid rather than EIA. So I encourage you guys, as you're thinking through your projects, get some industry data rather than EIA. My final, or one of my next to final slide here is the Lazard levelized cost info. I always found this useful as kind of a reality check. We're talking about renewables. Efficiency is still the cheapest next kilowatt, but after that, it's wind. And after that, you've got kind of natural gas combined cycle and utility scale PV kind of right in there. They're really cost competitive themselves. And residential rooftop is not that far behind. So we're seeing a change just based on 2014 data. Every reason to expect that trend is going to continue. And it really makes for an interesting challenge as you guys are designing programs while the marketplace is evolving as quickly as it is. My final slide is additional resources that my group, Advanced Energy Economy, has put out. We just had a webinar today on integrating renewable into the grid, looking at case studies from both ERCOT and Texas at Xcel on how they've been able to integrate it. A number of other reports that might be useful to you. So with that, I will stop in the interest of time and happy to take questions now or at the end of the call.
This is Tama from American Samoa. Just a quick question. Do you, those installations, do you have storage that comes with it?
Most of these, my understanding, do not have storage, although that is increasingly becoming part of the market. Not only utility scale storage and storage on the transmission grid, which I know is a big part of the system, but distributed storage is, it's not, I was about to say it's right around the corner, but literally mine's being installed today when the solar company came out, and it's not Solar City with their Tesla battery. They're getting all of the publicity, but just my local regional solar installer offered me a battery backup. So these are being installed now, and it's something you guys should be thinking about as the system evolves.
Thanks, Malcolm. I think
our system here in American Samoa, it 100% comes with storage, just FYI. So with the main reason is just we're going directly to the my office is going directly to the end users, but of course collaborating with utilities to fulfill all their required compliance and what have you in doing the interconnections. Thanks.
Thanks, Malcolm. I think that was a really helpful kind of overview of where, you know, how maybe states, especially undertaking financing programs, can look at the data and kind of get a better understanding of what the potential is for their state. I'd like to introduce Tom Kimbis with the Solar Energy Industries Association. They recently released a consumer guide for solar energy, and I think that could be a nice kind of complementary look at what the residential market's looking like and give states another sense of how to conduct programs in that sector. So, Tom, I'll pass the phone over to you now.
Thanks very much, Sandy. And I have Amir Yazdi, my colleague here at SIA, with me. First of all, thank you for allowing us to participate on the call, and it's great to follow my colleagues from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, one of our market leaders in solar, as well as, of course, Malcolm and AWE. So thanks to Nazio for and we appreciate your interest in solar. We were asked to speak about solar's obviously the hot topic, unfortunately politically, but more positively, I think, in terms of market growth. Here in Washington, but we were asked to speak today about consumer protection. And what we're trying to do here at SIA, we are the National Trade Association for Solar Energy with roughly 1,000 member companies from across the globe, all of whom do business in the U.S. We're trying to ensure that the fantastic growth that solar has experienced in states across the country, including those represented on the phone, continues. And one way we can do that is by taking a leadership role in the area of consumer protection, especially in regards to transactions with on the residential side, on the DG side with small commercial. SIA and its members, we want to do the right thing. We often feel like we're on the side of, on the right side of the energy debate. And want to continue, doing the right thing, showing leadership, and being the good corporate citizen. And I'm not going to repeat or go into the numbers that Malcolm got into. I will highlight just a couple, I think, just to put in context where the market is right now. Roughly 174,000 jobs. Those are Americans employed in the solar industry, either producing a product or service that enters the solar industry. That's from the Solar Foundation. Since 2006, the market of the solar industry has been growing at an average of 72% per year in CAGR, and will be about a $20 billion market evaluation this year. So I'm going to run through a couple of slides here. We don't have them up there, but what we have distributed And Sandy, I'm not sure if you're doing this after the call, if you've already done so, is that residential guide to solar power. Has that already gone out to folks?
Yep, it's posted on the event page.
Great, great. Yeah, so that, you know, that's an example of our Consumer Protection Committee that I'm going to be speaking about that we just started this spring. And we did so in an effort to really stay ahead of the curve of some issues that have been arising. And I think, you know, before diving into the consumer protection, I want to say that for the folks who are representing state energy offices out there, we're happy to speak with you. We're interested in speaking with you. We've spoken with some of you already regarding consumer protection. And if you do have any questions or concerns about it, you know, we're happy to, you know, work with you and show you what it is that we're developing. So in terms of consumer protection, what we had seen is an increase in allegations of consumer protection violations that had potentially damaging results to the industry. Attack pieces in the media that were damaging the good name of solar. States appropriately looking into legislation or regulation, but you know those actions could add cost and complexity to the solar transaction, and might be potential to be overbroad or off target. And so, like other national trade associations that have faced similar issues, we decided to act quickly, carefully, and strategically to address the consumer protection concerns that we were hearing about. So we developed the Consumer Protection Committee made up of our board members, and its mission is to address consumer-oriented issues within U.S. solar markets through actions that increase consumer, industry, government, and media understanding of solar energy transactions, technical capabilities and characteristics, while promoting the solar industry growth and competition. So basically, it's a very education-oriented mission and pro-competitive at the same time. At the heart of consumer protection efforts is self-regulation, and it's an industry, that's essentially an industry stepping forward and taking the tougher path forward and saying, we are going to take pains up front to regulate ourselves and offer that as an alternative to states and to the federal government. And the benefits to the industry, to solar, is that it you know, once the hard work is done up front and an actionable, you know, enforcement mechanism is put into place, it's flexible, it's less burdensome, it's less costly to the public than having to uphold government regulations. And it allows industry to be flexible as the characteristics of the technology and the shape of the market changes. It also shows, I think, some strong proactivity to our stakeholders, to industry, to consumers, et cetera. So the kind of core pieces of self-regulation are the development of the business code or the code of conduct, education that goes around that business code, and then an enforcement, the complaint investigation and enforcement process. There's also the option of getting to a certification of personnel and goods to certain standards. That's something we may explore at a later time, but that's sort of icing on the cake. The first step was development of a committee, which has been coming together since the springtime on a weekly basis, and really diving in and debating these issues and making sure we're putting our best minds to the task here. So some things that we've developed or in the process of developing are things like sales instruments in the area of materials development. This is an educational piece, but it's also designed to streamline and avoid confusion for the consumer, and also for the small to mid-sized solar company. So we have been working with NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab, Came up with some standardized documents that cover sales contracts and some other mechanisms, such as leases. And we are continuing to work on those and have brought on a full-time an FTE from NREL, who had been in charge of this program, to really lead the way for SIA and its member companies to put forward additional streamlined, standardized portions of the contract. We also are looking at and have a draft of a code of conduct. It's something that is not public, so I can't share it with you at this time, but it has made some significant advances through our committee and is going to be presented to our board later this fall. So I'm optimistic that it's something that we'll be able to roll out by the end of 2015. So in developing that sort of code, folks ask, you know, what exactly have you done in the past when you've had these any problems with consumer protection arise? SIA has maintained for the last 7 or 8 years a code of ethics, and I think of it as more of a set of aspirational principles by which companies, industry should operate, such as, you know, treat consumers in a professional and timely manner, offer and honor clear, understandable warranties that comply with all applicable laws and regulations. So this 10-part code of ethics has been in place, and we have been fielding complaints from the general public specific to portions of the code of ethics and looking into them. However, what we wanted to do is make sure we develop something much, much more specific that gave stronger guidance to companies as to what they should and shouldn't do, without going so far that we worry about getting into antitrust rules. So instead, what a code of conduct and what the one I hope rolls out by the end of the year will do is have specific rules that are really conducive to enforcement. The rules would be based on the principles that are up on our website, our code of ethics. And as soon as we do get that released, we will be working with the members of our industry, SIA members and non-members alike, to obtain as much industry-wide acceptance and adherence as possible. So I'm going to turn it to Amir. I know we're getting close to the top of the hour here, so to talk for just a couple minutes about the education component behind this, and then we'll go back to you, Sandy, and see if there's any questions.
So, yes, so as Tom mentioned, the Consumer Protection Committee's mission is very education focused, and essentially you could say that the whole process can be broken down into buckets, such as the development of materials, which includes things like the residential consumer guide to solar power that's on the website and the business code. And another component, though, is what we call more specifically education. And that kind of refers to, spreading these materials to, various audiences, the types of people that we're trying to reaching out to are, the consumers, solar companies, but also not just limited to them, but other parties that are interested in solar, such as government associations, such as NASIO, and other industries that are also interested in solar. So, as we mentioned, education, the materials that we have, that we're putting together, the business code and residential guide, but we are also developing other materials in the upcoming months, targeted more at the industry itself and other industries. So terms of one of the reasons why we're focused on education is that to us, informing consumers helps protect consumers, and informing and, you know, educating companies about best practices protects them as well. But also we want to make sure that, you know, everyone who's interested in solar, you know, has like a good solid understanding of what the technologies are, what are these contracts, what their options for going solar are, and, you know, other policies that affect the industry. So in terms of how we're going about with our education efforts, so what we're trying, what we are doing is, you know, besides publishing these materials on our website, what we're doing is going through putting together webinars targeted at, you know, the parties that might be interested in a specific topic, going to trade shows, and, you know, such as Solar Power International or other regional events. But also, I think probably most importantly, we're also trying to, you know, reach out to organizations such as NASIO, who have an interest in solar, and, you know, try you know, to help show you what SEIA is doing in terms of consumer protection. Plus, on top of it, you know, reaching out to local government organizations, business associations, and, you know, almost, and, you know, a wide range of, you know, groups. So, yeah, so that's actually, so that's just like the overview of our education efforts.
Great. So, Sandy, just throw it back to you if there's any questions.
Great. Thanks, and Tom. In the interest of time, I know we have a few states on the line, including Hawaii and Colorado, that have really interesting programs going on as well. So I did want to kind of give them a chance to share some news about their work. Marissa, I know you're on the line. Maybe kind of a one-minute update on the GEMS financing program would be wonderful. And I know we have the slides up on the event page for folks to reference.
Hi, thanks, Sandy. Yep, this is Marissa. I'm an energy analyst with the State Energy Office in Hawaii, and we're tasked with accomplishing our energy goals and providing planning and programs and assistance to do so. Sandy has the slides posted. My contact information is there, along with additional information about the GEMS program, the docket numbers, the legislation information. So you can feel free to refer to those or email me if you'd like to. We have a program out here in Hawaii called the Green Energy Market Securitization Program. That program's purpose was to expand the existing financing market to allow more access to clean energy technologies that will help lower energy costs for people. We found that though we have ample renewable energy resources, the distribution of those taking advantage of distributed generation was not quite equal to the population distribution. We found that a lot of those benefits were taking advantage of by the wealthier part of the population. So the GEMS program purpose was to expand that. The legislation that created the GEMS program back in 2013 had a two-part structure to do that. The first part laid out the foundation for the raising of capital for a fund, and that was done through the stranded asset securitization model that's been used for many years. And the second part is to create a financing program that can use that fund to help expand the access. So a little bit about the first part, the capital. We created a bond issuance team and created a securitized fee called the Green Infrastructure Fee, paid by all ratepayers, and that was used to raise $150 million in capital in the end of last year. We had really great ratings, and the issuance won a lot of awards. It was really a groundbreaking, innovative issuance. If you want more information about that, I've provided information on the slides. And then on the financing program side, we had to create an authority to govern the financing program, of which Mark Glick, the co-chair of the Fuels Committee, is on. And the authority is in charge of creating the products and essentially getting the money out into the market. We have a series of implementation teams, but the current status, in the interest of time, I'm skipping through, I'm on the last slide now. The current status is that we, on the bond side, we had our first true up, and that's gone into effect, and our first bond payment went into effect. That was all on July 1st. That went as planned and smoothly. And on the program side, we have actually already launched our nonprofit PV product. That was in March. We've launched our residential PV product. That was in June. And we actually just gained approval yesterday to begin the implementation of a commercial energy efficiency product. And though we haven't yet deployed any capital because we need to fund the loans and have the installations installed, on the PV product side, we've received over 70 applications thus far, many of which are pre-approved. So yeah, that's a quick update. And as I said, feel free to reach out if you have any other questions. Thanks, Sandy.
Thanks, Marissa. And I know we're just at the end of our hour, but I wanted to see if anyone from Colorado is on the line, because they do have a really exciting new community solar initiative, which I was hoping, you know, we could also get in front of the committee, but I don't think I heard anyone from Colorado during roll call.
Outreach manager for the Colorado Energy Office. And I realize we're really short on time, so just really high level, we recently released an RFA for a project that's intended to bring a minimum of a megawatt of community shared solar power designed specifically for low income households online within the next 2 years. So the intent is to hire an administrator who will implement a minimum of 5 demonstration projects that in aggregate amount to 1 megawatt of solar power specifically for low-income households and in particular community shared solar. So we'd be happy to go into some more detail maybe at a future call. We'd like the administrator to really talk about the specifics. But we're really excited to be in the community shared arena, especially as it relates to low-income solar, and we're pretty excited to see what this project brings about. And as part of our work on this project, we've also recently joined the newly created White House. The National Community Solar Partnership that was recently launched by the White House. And I know some of the other folks on the call are also involved in that as well. So really that's building off of the initiative to increase solar access to all Americans, especially in those in distressed communities and in low and median household income, medium income households. So we'd be more than happy to talk about this in some more detail if it would make sense for a future call.
Great. Thanks so much, Adrian and Marissa. And, you know, as we were doing some research on how to build this agenda, we found that there was just a ton of examples that we could highlight. So I do think that, you know, this warrants a second joint call between our committees to really delve in further, both on the financing piece and, you know, some of the community solar and other programs that are out there. So I'll turn it over to Jeff to help adjourn this call and tee up our next one, I guess. Okay. Actually, I'll just go ahead and adjourn it. Well, thank you everyone for your time and for sticking it out for the extra few minutes. And we'll be in touch with follow-up and with more information about American Samoa and the other programs and a future call on delving deeper into solar. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, this is Tom from American Samoa. Thank you so much, Sandy. Appreciate it.
Great. Take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks, folks.
The organizer has disconnected, and this conference will continue for 60 minutes.